This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
You guys, Deb Perlman's here. Oh my God. Hi there. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Liz Hoddle, and I'm the Director of Events at Politics and Prose. And I'm so happy to see this absolutely packed house here to welcome Deb to D.C. for Smitten Kitchen every day. It's a unique challenge to introduce an author who all of us in this room feel like we already know and are friends with. It was kind of hard for me when I met Deb backstage not to ask about Anna and Jacob, despite the fact that, of course, I've never met them. It's a little creepy. Deb is a self-taught home cook and photographer, and the Smitten Kitchen Cookbook was a New York Times bestseller. Her blog reaches millions of readers every month. Her work is defined by her precise, trustworthy recipes, but even more so, I think, by her honesty and lack of pretension. There are no turmeric lattes here. There's beautiful, generous food to share with the people you love. I don't know about any of you in this room, but so many food writers just make me feel bad about myself. Like I'll never reach grain bowl perfection with 100 perfectly cut and placed radishes around a bowl of perfectly done quinoa. I just want to quit before I even get started. But when you read Deb's recipes, you feel encouraged and accompanied. She reminds us that mistakes are beautiful and that the messy, funny, and perfect stuff that happens in the kitchen, that's the good stuff. The subtitle of this new cookbook says it all. Triumphant and unfussy new favorites. And since I've had the cookbook a little bit longer than all of you, I must share just three words. Toasted, marshmallow, milkshake. That's all. Just sit with that for a second. That is all. Tonight, Deb is in conversation with Sally Swift, the co-creator and managing producer of The Splendid Table. The Splendid Table has been a crucial platform for food reporting and writing for over 20 years. You can download the podcast on NPR One or at the Apple Store. And if you love food writing, I can't encourage you enough to dive in. There's so much special stuff there. Please help me welcome Sally Swift and Deb Perlman to Six and I.
Nice, right? Welcome to Washington. Here she is. So, Deb, you've actually spent a lot of time in Washington.
It's my favorite city. I don't say that.
You're not. What did you say in Philadelphia last night?
I did not say the same thing to Philadelphia. I said, I love Zahav, as everybody does. No, I'm not supposed to pick favorites, but I love it here so much. I went to school here, undergrad and grad. I tried to stay as long as I could. DC is a much better city today. There's so much more going on. But I moved directly here from New York, where I have been since. But I love being back here, so thank you.
It's great to have you back. I want to talk to you a little bit. We're definitely going to talk to people about your food. But I want to know, will you tell the story of how your blog got the name? Because I'm not sure a lot of people know. It started out as just Smitten. Correct?
It was just Smitten. I think everyone imagines that it's this schmoopy thing, like love and, I mean it is, but I always like the duality of the word smite and also smitten. So I mean probably we lean more towards the latter, but I always like that there was a little bit of an edge to it. Not that I have much of an edge left, but so before I had the Smitten Kitchen, I just wrote about whatever. I had a blog called Smitten, and that was from 2003 on. I'm an old blogger, which is hilarious, because I'm 26 now, so how could I be blogging? I was a very precocious middle schooler.
You were pre-curve.
but back then, you know, your blog didn't have to have, like, a focus or
right.
anything.
But you did have a focus. Smitten had a focus.
I mean, I would talk a little bit about dating and New York life, and I would talk about food more and more. So come 2006, I decided to just go full steam ahead with the food.
But is it true that you were indeed, you launched doing this little bit of a dating, like single girl out, and then the fourth person who writes you winds up as your husband. Is that true? Is that a true story?
Yeah, I mean, I thought I'd write some dating stories, and I was, a very early commenter, probably. Probably had been blogging for about 3 weeks, and I went out, and we went for a drink, and then we got married 2 years later, so guess I don't have a dating blog anymore. Better find a new topic.
Rename the blog. Off you go. You also had a career selling records.
I did. I mean, I don't know, like it was like a
cook, yeah, but
like
you worked in a record store, which is like really a hip thing that you can tell your kids
so,
later.
I was so hip, guys. No, they're not going to believe me. I worked at a record store. I worked at Tower in D.C. for years.
Aww, I know.
So, yeah, I worked at Tower for years when I was an undergrad and when I was in grad school for a bit until I was able to get a different job. But I loved it, though. I loved pretty much, like, you know, once a day somebody would come in and they would sing the song to me. I'm not going to do it because I already have a cold and you do not want to hear me sing even when I don't have a cold. But they would be like, can you tell me about that Cure song, Karma Elise?
Oh, I love that. I never thought about that.
It's not the Cure, but this is like once a day occurrence. And I don't know, I found it really fun to help people find the music they were looking for.
Wow, I hadn't thought about people coming in and singing a song to try and place it.
I know, but it was always like the same thing.
Party trick.
Yeah, I know. I should dust this off, see what I remember now.
So, why do you like to cook?
I'm supposed to talk now about nourishment and home.
Not necessarily.
And heart and nutrition and family and love. I'm actually just really picky. I'm really picky. I want things a certain, when I'm cooking especially, I want things a certain way and I love tweaking things to get them the way I want them to be. And once I tweak them, I don't want to forget it. So I write them down. And that's really where the blog came from, which was that I tweaked this and I mashed it up with this and I think that everyone should make it this way and not that. I'm also a little bit bossy when I find something I like. So it really came from there where I just wanted to tell people these things that I tried and that had worked, that had made it much better.
It's interesting because you wrote something in your book that I was really struck by. You said how great home cooking is because you get to make it exactly the way you want. And I don't think most people feel that way about cooking.
Well, then you need better recipes.
which you have been after.
Well, I mean, there's more sources for good recipes. But, yeah, I mean, obviously. but I think it's true. I feel like, you know, if you, and we all go through phases where we're not cooking so much,
yeah.
Or sometimes we call it like a whole lifetime. But, you know, I get busy for a couple weeks and we do a mix of takeout or like some deli chicken soup or, you know, we kind of mishmash that. And I really just miss getting food the way I want it, you know, and I feel like the desire to cook again comes back when you give it a rest when you need to. And it's fun getting something right. I feel like that to me was really the triumphant part. If you're sitting there thinking like, I don't know how to make challah or, you know, roast chicken or meatballs or whatever it is, and then you do it, you feel awesome. I want to do like a victory lap around the kitchen. Like, you get so happy. It becomes the highlight of your day and not like one more piece of drudgery, one more thing that you have to do. And I'm chasing those experiences. I feel like we should focus on those.
Your writing totally represents that. I mean, I think you write that way. You're so intimate. Who were you writing to when you first started writing about food? Because I feel like there's such an intimate quality to your writing. I felt like, you know, in radio they always tell you to think about like the one person you're talking to make you feel intimate. Your writing feels that way to me. I feel like you're really just almost like you're on the phone with your girlfriend.
I think so. Maybe. My God, I haven't thought about that. I'm just picturing you guys. God, I'm such a kiss. What's up? I don't know. I feel like maybe a little bit my grandmother, who always thought I should be a writer and was a very good cook.
Aww.
And a little bit kind of everybody else. I feel like, you know, because I have the comment section, mm-hmm. I know what the voice of a reader sounds like. And they're... they're usually very nice people that I want to talk to. So
yeah, and you really engaged with your readers.
I find it really interesting. I want to hear how everything's going. As soon as somebody tells me they've made a recipe from the book, I'm like, how did it go? I'm going to hold my breath until you tell me it worked. I want to hear it, and I find it really interesting. I love to hear what things were difficult, what things didn't work as planned, what things worked better than you expected, what tweaks you made, if the portions worked for you. I mean, this is basically just free market research for me. So I think it helps make me a better cook, but I also just, I love hearing how it plays out in people's homes. I only have a test population of my own family, so it might be a very limited perspective.
I think you have a bigger test population than that, as you can see.
Right, I mean, right.
Tell us about, so you had a vegetarian period, and you write a really funny story about being on the street going to work and changing your mind. Will you tell us that?
Right. So I used to work at a small B2B magazine, and they let us roll in pretty late, which was nice. And it meant that when I was going to work and I'd be picking up like a muffin and coffee, I would pass the street cart, like the halal carts, starting to make the chicken and rice for the day. And they would be like chop, chop, chopping, and the spices would come down the street and like smack me in the face. And I'm like, why am I eating a muffin? Why am I drinking coffee? Why am I not having chicken and rice for breakfast? Why don't I eat chicken? I was a vegetarian at the time, and it really unsettled me how good it smelled. Even now, I can be completely full, and if the smell like were to waft across the stage, I would like immediately want it.
And you created that in your book. You did a recipe.
I tried to do my best to recreate it, so it's.
It's a long recipe too.
It is, and it's. You said it's a long recipe.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. Yeah. There's a
well,
lot
to
it.
You've got the rice and you have the chicken.
Yeah.
But I actually really love to make it when you have people over. I think people are expecting something fancy, and we were actually just on Tuesday at a friend's place, and she had like 18 people over with their kids for a Halloween dinner, and she made like a quadruple batch of it. And I mean, in my unbiased opinion, I thought it was the best thing.
Everyone's happy.
No, I thought it came out great. It was such a fun thing to eat when you're expecting something formal. I feel like it was so cozy, and you get the salad, and you get the pita, and you get the spice. I feel like the meat's in a good balance where you're not eating too much of it. You know, it's well balanced on the plate. I tried.
What else are you? I think the recipe looks great. I mean, it totally looks great. You reference a lot of international foods in this book. Can you tell us kind of like some of your secret things that you found that you're employing now, your secret ingredients?
You know, that was a really tough one because I was trying to figure out how much was too much and how much was alienating. I mean, I'm just dabbling. This is not authentic Thai or whatever, but
right.
I think a lot of us these days have a bottle of fish sauce or have tried Ottolenghi recipes, and maybe you have some pomegranate molasses around. I don't want to put ingredients in that are hard for people to get, but I feel like certain things are just, they're not foreign anymore. They're
That's
just
right.
things that are mixed in. So I love sumac. It just tastes like a sour paprika. It has a little more texture, and I love that on vegetables. I feel like it really brightens them up while adding this really beautiful garnet rubbly color. What else? I know fish sauce really freaks people out, but it's so good with lime juice, garlic, and ginger with pretty
it's
much
It's kind
anything.
Of a magic ingredient, I have to say. And just a little will do you. Years ago, John Willoughby, who was an editor at Gourmet, and he's been with America's Test Kitchen for years, but he has for years just put a little drop in his vinaigrette.
Ooh.
It is perfect.
It's like that umami.
It's
thing.
Perfect. No one ever knows. He never tells anyone. It is really quite the. It is really. Now you will all do this, but it's pretty amazing.
Like it's hard to, like, I know people, we all get really freaked out by the sound of it, you know, when you think really hard about it. But the truth is that there's fish sauce like. There's an Italian version of it. There's a, you know.
Garum from the Roman era,
exactly.
Right?
We've all been wanting something salty and funky to just kind of lift the other flavors.
Yep. Do you think our palate's changing?
You know, it's hard to say. I feel like with these days, it's much easier to get a lot of foods that we couldn't. So with that, yes, and also a thirst for food that matches the way our country and our cities mm-hmm. look. I think it's great. I like the mingling.
Mm-hmm. I do too. And I think we crave that hit more than we used to. You know, we need a little more bang than we have had needed in the past, which I'm sure we're going to quiet down again. But right now, with all of the stuff going on, it's kind of interesting.
It does. It feels really, you know, so I went to this, I went when I was in Montreal maybe like a year and a half ago, I went to a Syrian restaurant, and it was a really kind of fancy Syrian restaurant, and I'm completely forgetting the name of it, but I will find it because it was like one of the best meals. It was like a top 10 meal of the year, and I was thinking, why don't we have a upscale Syrian restaurant in New York City? Why is, without getting political,
yeah,
well, why is this even a thing that we wouldn't have? Anyway, it was just, it was a really lovely place.
I love those little pieces that you get from other cultures, and something else you write about in your book is it's the Italian breadcrumb thing. What do you call it again?
The pangrattato. Yes.
Tell us about that. We're all going to be doing this, let me tell you.
It's just highly seasoned. It roughly translates kind of as poor man's Parmesan, but it's breadcrumbs that you cook in olive oil with garlic and chili flakes. There's a lot of different versions of it, but this seasoning, this thing, and I found that, you know, you don't need to worry about having fancy breadcrumbs. The Japanese breadcrumbs that are pretty available called panko work really well as a base, and then you don't have to plan ahead and have stale bread. But I love it as a little layer. I have it in this spaghetti dish that actually started on the site, and you finish it with a crispy egg. And by the way, it's really funny because the recipe is from, it started in with like Jamie Oliver and then Arthur Schwartz.
The breadcrumb recipe.
Yeah, the breadcrumb with the pasta and the crispy egg. And then it kind of trickled through the Food 52 site where I picked it up and tweaked it some more. And I reached out to the person from the Food 52 site to make sure they were okay with me sharing it, you know, my adaptations. And it turned out it's Amanda Hesser's sister. So
it's a small world. Who runs the Food 52? Who runs Food 52?
Yeah, so it just trickles through. But it's such a great, like, you come home late. Or
and you,
don't
keep it, you keep it on hand. Do you keep it in the fridge?
I feel like if I make it, I'll make enough to do it a few times. Because once you have it, like, why would you want to make the crumbs each time? But yeah, it's definitely worth making. I keep it in the fridge.
Right.
It tends to stay pretty crisp.
And what else do you keep in the fridge?
I keep a jar of that totally inauthentic Caesar dressing that's part of the kale salad. I'm actually a little worried because I went away without like leaving extra of the dressing at home. It's very fridge stable, so I make a triple or quadruple batch of it, and it keeps in the fridge for as long as you remember to keep it there. So I'll have something like that, and maybe some of the crumbs too that I use in that, which are like a different version, but they all work the same. And then all you need to do is bring home whatever greens you want. We've put it on roasted broccoli. We've put it on roasted cauliflower. We were basically Caesar-ing everything once we came up with that. I found that dressing that was my perfection.
There you go. It's perfect to have around. So your life is changed since you wrote your first book. In that you have two kids now.
Right.
So how has that changed your cooking?
Well, my son is a wonderful eater. He eats everything. He's pretty good. I mean, obviously he would rather have like spaghetti or pizza. He's still a normal 8-year-old boy. Now I have my daughter too.
Who's two?
Who's two? It's a little different.
You don't get two good eaters. It's just against the rule.
No. It's just really funny because I totally had this kid coming to me. Like, this was my hubris brought this. This was totally going to happen. So, and then we have our other child who eats. I don't even know what she eats. I gave her a crispy chickpea, like, right. You know those crunchy ones, all seasoned and
right.
salty? And I gave it to her, and she spit it out. And she said, no, Mommy, no. So, and of course she gets away with everything. She's so cute. But yeah, no, I really found, and this was really one of the biggest changes between the first book and the second, was when I wrote my first book, my son was, when I was finishing up, it takes a while to get things, you know, through editing and printer, but he was two, and we were mostly just kind of dabbling at family dinners. Like, he would join us, we would chop some food on the side, you know, scrape off a sauce if it freaked him out, but it was pretty, I felt like we were just playing at family dinners. By the time my daughter came around, it was like, I don't know, it was a huge adjustment. I felt like changing from one kid to two, like, they do, half of your family needs dinner at 6 p.m. or will very audibly let you know they're not okay with not having dinner in various behavioral ways. And it was like, wow, I mean, I, didn't I just feed you guys yesterday? Again? Same time? I'm like, I cook for a living, and I was still like, this is serious. Like, I really, and I felt like so many of the things that I loved making just really didn't work. Now, if you just want like a 20-minute meal or some 5-ingredient chicken, like, I mean, the internet is your oyster. You don't need to come to me for that. So I was really, one of the reasons this book took me so long to write is I was trying to find what it meant to me to do slightly more everyday cooking. I didn't want to make food that was just about rushing you out of the kitchen, but I also knew that, you know, I too was in much more of a rush, and I was trying to figure out what everyday cooking would look like if you loved cooking and were trying to, like, hold on to the joy of it without actually having all the time in the world to, like, julienne vegetables. I mean, nobody likes julienning vegetables.
You can buy julienne vegetables.
Okay, so that sounds good. Maybe I should start writing recipes for julienne vegetables again. So yeah, trying to find out, I felt like I couldn't find a template for that. You know, I feel like there's chef cooking and then there's 30-minute meals, and there wasn't, I felt like there wasn't a whole lot in between.
Do you write differently for a book than you do your blog?
I don't think so, but I am, you know, not all the stories that I would share in the blog, we did this yesterday, here's a thing I'm making next week, here's a thing that happened on Sunday, it doesn't actually work in book form. So I find that I do try to make sure that it works. And it's true of the recipes too, where it may not be like, here's a candy for, you know, next Tuesday or something like that. So it's a little bit different. I mean, it should be the same, but it's not.
Yeah, the timing is different.
It's like a different muscle somehow, yeah.
Yeah. Who is writing these days that you are loving and are interested in?
Oh my goodness. I loved Julia Tertian's Small Victories. I'm spending a little bit of time in bookstores this fall, so I'm going to lean more heavily on more recent
You're browsing books. The shelves?
I do. I always look around. I'm loving Alison Roman's Dining In book. I love her opinions on things. They're fierce and sharp.
Who is Alison Roman?
She's a former Bon Appetit editor. Right. She's doing some writing for the New York Times, and she is very good at cooking dinner. I mean, there's so many great dinner ideas in there. And I love the book. What else? My God, who?
Are there classics you go to? Like, is there something, what's your reference book? Most writers have a reference book
you
of
know,
some
I'm
sort.
Julia Child, of course.
Yep.
I actually tend to have a lot of, you know, the cooking of Tunisia, cooking of Hungary, those kinds of books that are kind of like the best reference from each country. I kind of enjoy having those on the shelves, even if I don't, usually the recipes are very dry, but I find them very useful as a springboard when I'm trying to, so if I'm talking about pan grattato or whatever, like at least I'm looking at some Italian cookbook. I would say those are the ones I probably pull down from the shelf.
So which Italian cookbook?
I mean, I have the Silver Spoon, and of course I have Marcella's on, but that to me is more of a, that's the one where you use the recipes, but I kind of like the more encyclopedic. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of a lot of those cookbooks from, I'm going to say it wrong, Faden?
Yeah, Faden.
Okay. Yeah, I love a lot of, I just keep them around, and I don't necessarily cook the recipes so much letter to letter, but when I'm trying to look at it, what a core idea of what Russian honey cake is, or blini, or... you know, kind of a core idea of pad thai. I find it very useful to start there.
You don't Google it?
Google it too, but the thing is with Google is that the things on the top are going to be, well, of course, American websites and American, which is fine, but I feel like, okay, for example, this month I got, last month I was really, been obsessed with making a classic Dutch apple pie for a long time, and I found that on American websites, Dutch apple pie is a deep dish apple pie with crumbs on top, but that's not what the Holland apple tart is, which I'm not going to even try to pronounce correctly. It's in a springform pan with an almost cookie crust with egg in it, and there's less sugar inside, and there's always, it's a totally different thing. So I found that by going on Dutch Google and looking up and then using Translate, I was getting a much clearer picture.
It's like a kuchen. It's like a kuchen or something, right?
Yes, I mean, exactly. It's actually much more like a cake, and they're always, but I found a lot of consistency. I found this consistency in American recipes, but it wasn't what I was looking for. And sometime in the next year or two, I hope to share that recipe with you because it came out.
Year or two?
I'm trying to think.
It's a lot of apples going down in Deb's kitchen.
It came out great. But it took me a long time, and I really had to, like, get it. So sometimes Google results are great, but sometimes they, it was a very clear thing where everyone agreed on what Dutch apple pie was, and it wasn't what my Dutch next door neighbor says it is.
Right. And not to mention, it's important to read people who actually do the work and are actually really developing recipes and be careful where you Google. I'm just going to say.
That's a good mantra for these days. I found it, I love watching home cooking videos on YouTube from other countries, especially when they don't speak English. It's fine. I feel like when you've got some grandmother and she's got her son showing her how to make,
From where? Give us an example of one.
This little old lady in Italy and her son's filming, and my grandmother makes the best, trophy pasta, and he's showing how she makes it, and it's like, this is not fancy, it's not edited. The videos are 23 minutes for a short recipe.
Right, right.
BuzzFeed Tasty would fall over.
Right.
And it's it's the opposite, but you get, you wouldn't be sharing this unless you were very proud of it. And I feel like there's so much more to be learned there sometimes.
Yeah, and capturing, that's a really an interesting thing to capture our relatives, right? Because we all know people that have made something a certain way. And with our little iPhones now, here we go.
I wish I had a video of all of them.
Yeah, right? Yeah. We're going to take questions in a little bit, so you can start lining up if you are interested in asking Deb anything. You are really open about crediting other people for your recipes, which I love. I think people who don't admit that that's what they do when they're developing a recipe, for you, what is the line? Because you will go and you will credit someone, but you're still going to take it and change it. When does it become yours?
I've heard people say that you can change three ingredients and it becomes
that
yours.
Used to be the rule.
I won't do it. I won't do it. My line is I need to sleep well at night and I need to feel like I'm not. I would so much rather give somebody credit. Literally talking about Amanda has her sister in this and whatever, even if I did my own thing with a recipe, I think it's not just about being honest. I think it makes a better recipe story. Wouldn't you rather see where the roots of the recipe come from than to pretend that I sat around my kitchen one day and invented crispy breadcrumbs? I didn't. I didn't invent lasagna and I didn't invent pizza. And I always feel like when I see a recipe that doesn't talk at all about where it learned what it was, mm-hmm. I'm always like, but where was it? Mm-hmm. It feels a little suspect to mm-hmm. me.
And of course, all those great culinary scholars, Claudia Roden, Julia Child, Diana Kennedy, they are, of course, all talking to home cooks that they've mm-hmm. taken that information and given it up. But you are very good at that, and I love the freedom you have to just say it. And you just take it and you turn it into something else. I really respect that.
Thank you. I kind of wish everybody felt you don't have to pretend you invented it.
Right.
There's this idea you're not going to get a book deal or something.
Right.
I don't understand. I don't want to live in this world. I want to. So anyway, and I also I have this huge fear. What if somebody who I did, in some part taught me a bit about mirepoix or something like that, and they saw it and they saw something that belonged to them and they weren't credited. I would feel terrible. I've been there. I've seen people of course. Yeah. Take my stuff and not credit, and it feels awful because it just, you could have just said it.
It's an easy thing to do.
Yeah, anyway.
Okay, let's go. Do you want to start?
I would love to start. Hi, so happy to be here and have the chance to hear you talk. I actually teach at a tiny all-women's college in Southwest Virginia, and I research in feminist rhetoric in the digital sphere, and I actually just finished my doctoral dissertation on food blogs. This is coming to a point.
Uh-oh.
I want to see if you send it to me.
This isn't a question I was going to ask, but I really can't pass up the chance to actually hear what you think about it. So I struggle individually as a younger woman who is really ambitious and very career-driven, but so obsessed with food writing and cooking and domestic activity, which I think, given the turnout and the internet-driven Pinterest crafting DIY food blogosphere turnout, a lot of people are, so I'm really curious if you have any thoughts on the intersection of that sort of domesticity-driven involvement with 2017 gender politics. Just a little light discussion.
Welcome back to Washington.
How long do you guys have? I could be here for days. Is there a specific part, or you just want me to just run off at the mouth and see how many people I can offend along the way? Because I can do it. I've done it before.
Yeah, I mean, whatever jumps to mind.
I think about it a lot.
Do you struggle with that as an individual who's very prominent as a woman in the kitchen?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I strongly identify as a feminist, and I've thought about that. You know, I have such an old-fashioned-looking domestic life, and it seems like I'm aspiring to be some sort of domestic goddess, and I try to make it as clear to people as possible that I am whatever the opposite of a domestic. I might have a way in the kitchen, but like laundry, my husband has this, he thinks I don't know where the laundry room is in our building. Like, no, I'm not. But then again, so it's very interesting. It's very easy to find yourself in a place where you are, you know, very aligned with a very, say regressive, but a traditional view of women's roles. And I think it's important not to be scared of that. You know what I mean? You go about it your own way and you do your own thing. And this is where I'm like, I need a little structure for this answer, because it's definitely something I think about a lot. But in the end, I think that one of the things that got me to start my site and got me started cooking was that I reached adulthood, or ostensibly reached adulthood, and I realized I didn't know how to make like anything, you know, like roast chicken or chicken noodle soup or fry an egg. And it wasn't because my parents didn't cook, it was just that nobody was like, daughter, you're gonna be, you know, a wife one day and you're gonna need to cook for your family, so let me teach you how to stand in front of a stove. I think we all want better, you know, or more opportunities. So I think a lot of us had similar experiences, but I don't think that teaching nobody to cook is the answer. We just need to be teaching everybody to cook, boys and girls.
Yep.
It shouldn't. Yeah, so I think that that's really where, when people say that they grew up and they didn't know how to cook, it was, I understand how it happened, but I think that what needs to change is that we need to be teaching everybody. It's not domestic arts, it is life skills. Yeah. So hopefully we'll see that changing. I think it is.
And there's joy involved.
There is. I feel
so
like
that's the piece
be the
that,
best part of
you
your
know,
day. I love the idea of really, this idea of just being around the table with people you love, like, this is not domestic arts. This is a good life, you know, and I want to have one, and I hope to make it easier for other people to find it.
Yep. Sorry to start you with a tough
It's okay, I'm on
I'll
it.
I'll ease you into it.
Maybe got a softball
yeah,
question.
I thought my question might be difficult, but now I don't. Mike, thanks for being here with us. My question is about being, I think, one of the longer running food bloggers. I mean, I started reading in like 2010, which is not even close to the beginning of where you started. My question is on, you seem like kind of a perfectionist, and I mean that as a compliment, and that's, I think, part of why we're all really impressed with your very reliable recipes. So my question is, how do you look back at your 2005 work, and I mean, your food photography, the way you wrote the recipes, how do you like live with, do you feel like you've improved.
How do you live with your old work? Is that the question?
as somebody who's always perfecting, like, how do you let kind of old work stand? I've seen you do updates of recipes or even just food photography updates, and I'm curious kind of how you make that decision when something needs an update versus tried and true classic that you still love 10, 15 years later.
So here's where I think you might think I'm more professional than I am. And for me, it was just like, I felt like cooking this tonight, and this photo's ready, so let me go grab my camera. But the nice thing is because comments exist on, you know, I would know if a recipe didn't work. And so I know they work. Their photos might be terrible. And my God, I mean, listening to me complain about how hard my life was is hilarious. But that's par for the course. I mean, it's adorable. Life is really hard. Terrible. But I think it was usually tongue-in-cheek anyway. But I sort of like going back and revisiting some of the old stuff. I go through phases where I only want to cook new things, and then I go through phases where I only want to kind of like go into the... I was going through a lot of 2006 and 2007 recipes this summer, and it was super fun for me because I picked these recipes for a reason. They were really good, and I often haven't made some of them in years myself. So I like going back and tweaking them, especially... You know, if there's something that comes up in the comments all the time that people like it better, you know, in a different way. I also find it really useful to put them through the 2017 filter, which is that, oh God, that step is so fussy. Just get rid of that. Mm-hmm. You don't need it. I think I answered that, right?
You did.
Going back, rewinding the question.
Yeah.
Some of them, I just look at it and it like it looks completely awful to me, but... It's okay. I mean, I feel like if I were to just put everything through a 2017 lens, that would be like a less interesting sight. So it's a real life, and so some days are messier than others.
And it's a well for you. You know, you get to go back and redo your work.
It is fun, and I kind of like that. I like it. I'd like to, you know, the work, I have a list of like maybe, we'll say 75 of the worst looking recipes on the site. And when I'm thinking of something to make for dinner and I don't want to do something new, I will try to hit one of those.
How many recipes do you have on the site? Do you know?
Probably about 1,200. It's crazy. I know. When did that happen?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
I know. Well, you've been at it for a long time.
But it was just one at a time. You know?
I know. It's just the crazy thing, right? People say that about children, too. So just be...
But no, that's two. I can count that high.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here tonight and all the recipes you've shared with us over the years. Every day on the blog, we get like a little tidbit into your life, but I was just curious, what does a typical day in the life of Deb look like?
Oh my goodness. Okay, so it usually starts with somebody yelling for breakfast. So I would say like a weekday is like, actually, my husband's the first one out of bed. Like, I'm trying to, no, my husband handles, like, everything in the morning, usually. He's kind of a saint. I shouldn't even tell you this because it's not. So we get the two kids dressed. They both go to different schools. Each is half a mile from our apartment, but they are, like, a mile apart. So we've realized that we need to divide and conquer. So we switch off who takes who.
Sorry.
He did tell me to keep it at my chin. I have this, like, I don't want to give anything germs. I'm like, it's a microphone, Dad. You can do this. it really depends on the day. I either go to the gym or I get right to work. And I usually spend the morning doing more writing and thinking tasks, if that makes sense. Like, you know, I'll go through comments or update the site or try to handle emails, usually quite badly. And then in the afternoon, I do more... cooking. I find that by the afternoon I can't, like my writing energy is gone. Oh, and I usually hit the grocery store in the morning. So if I'm doing it correctly, what I usually do is after the kids, like then it gets into dinner time, I usually cook through the afternoon. And then once with the whole bath bed routine, I'm usually trying to make a list for what I want to make the next day so I can hit the grocery store before I start working while I'm out running errands. It's really boring.
Do you have anyone, assistants or any other people?
I told this to somebody last week and they were like, I don't. I have a babysitter. No, I've been doing this site on my own and the books. Yeah,
that's
for a while.
Amazing.
I know. I really, it's a problem. It's not good. I've been like, my husband, my editor, my agent, they're like, begging me to hire an assistant, and I swear I'm gonna do it. I need another person.
I'm going
to hire this winter. I think it's time. I feel like I don't know. I'm not very good at outsourcing. And the result is that I'm just very slow at everything. But I've just always done it myself. I have a little bit of help with like PR and stuff from my publishers.
Okay.
They like take care of the book. I'm not like scheduling a book tour or anything. That would be crazy.
Well, very cool. By just the number of recipes is incredible. So
yep.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yep. Hi. I'm wondering what you think about boxed meals like Blue Apron and Plated and all of this, and if there'll be a Smitten Kitchen meal service.
Oh God, no.
It's just her.
No. with your assistant.
See Deb, Julian, and Carrots.
Sometimes, so it takes me 5 years to write a book. Could you imagine? Like, I would have a meal service for you in 2030. So I actually think they're great, though. I know a lot of people who use them that are people who once enjoyed cooking or just don't have the time for it. And I think what they really save you is, it's, you know, the selection process, finding a recipe that's going to work. Then you have to go to the grocery store. Maybe you have to go to two or three, one place for the protein,
yep.
One place you can go to the farmer's market for the, you know, nice
yeah.
vegetables. I think it's sort of cool the way it kind of brings it all together so you can just focus on the part you like, which is cooking, in a reasonable period of time. And I actually think that more often than not, they become a springboard to people cooking on their own. Like, I have a friend who likes this one service, and then she's like, oh, I did this thing with sausage and whatever the other night. I was like, yeah, I have a recipe for that in my book, by the way. But you know, they do it once from the kit, and the next time they're like, yeah, I'll go to the grocery store and get that myself. So the kits might be eventually putting themselves out of business, but I feel like for a lot of friends, it's become, like, it got them cooking again. And I think it's really cool. Mm-hmm. Or the flip side is they always say, like, the new unused Blue Apron meals is like the new unread New Yorker magazine.
It's exactly right.
In people's apartments, causing them guilt. But I feel like for most people, it can be, I think it's cool. I mean, I think it's sort of nice to take some of the parts that you don't like out of cooking and focus on the parts you do, sauteing, braising, you know, and then you get a new recipe out of it.
So first of all, I felt a flash of panic when I realized that your tiny baby is now almost 9. That was a
really scary thing. What is happening?
Yeah, like I, a 24-year-old, was reading your blog at 15, which was a weird realization.
Wow.
But, my question was, how do I, someone who grew up loving to cook, who comes from a long line of people who loves to cook, share that with someone else who absolutely hates it, gets a cold sweat when they step in the kitchen? Like, how do you teach someone to love it?
So I feel like, don't even worry about the teaching. Trust that my theory is just, I feel like if you're hungry for something, if there's something that nobody else makes right, start there. You know what I mean? Like, or when it comes winter and you're craving chicken noodle soup, like, good luck finding it from some, although I just met women who have a great chicken soup business in D.C., so maybe in D.C. you're covered, but for New York, I can't think of a place that makes really amazing chicken soup. I feel like pick what you're craving and that will be your impetus to get the recipe right, to work through a recipe, because, yeah, when you get to make the thing that you really want, I feel like it's not work. I feel like when most of my friends actually don't cook. It's really funny. I'm like, I cook, they don't need to. I think that's
you cook and you test.
I always have extras, so it all works out, but most of my friends don't cook, but they're like, I need to start cooking, and they're thinking, like, I have to go take a knife skills class. I have to learn how to cook quinoa. I'm like, no, you don't. Just pick something you want to make that. Then pick something else you want to make and make that. And it just goes from there.
Are you talking about kids?
No, I was talking about a 30-year-old man.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, find out what his favorite dish is and whether he wants to make it at home. I mean, I think it really just comes from, like, hunger, you know?
It's hard when Whole Foods has $7 sushi ready to go.
Thanks. Hi.
So I'm going to New York City next weekend, and I just really want, like, a food recommendation from you, like a restaurant or, like, dessert place. Like, where are you going lately?
Well, what are you craving?
Like, dessert, probably.
Well, you have to
go to Deb's house.
You have to.
No. I know you mean.
I'm not going to be there. I have no food in my fridge right now. You should go to Bread's Bakery and get their famous babka.
Okay, Bread's Bakery.
I'm like trying to think, you know, I've got a coffee shop that makes really good croissants. Like, I've got a page on my site called Deb's New York with some of my favorites on it. And they're kind of like random. You know, it's not like a you know, it's not like I've been to every bagel place in the city, but these are sort of the places that I go to a lot. I have my favorite restaurants that I go back to all the time, and I add more when I find them. So
yeah,
I think you can
have you
good
been to Seed and Nut, the halva place?
What is this?
Oh man. What's the little market? What's the market in Chelsea? It's a
Oh, the tahini,
the halva place.
Yes, it's wonderful.
It's called Seed and Nut, and it is. Is that right?
Seed and Nut. Seed and Mill. It's delicious.
Seed and Mill.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
You should go. You can spend some time. Now I understand Chelsea Market just moved all of their baked goods to the. They moved all their cooking stuff to the second floor. I haven't been back there since, but I'm actually hoping it'll
be worth it.
More pleasant to walk through because it's always. They also have a. I'm going to say it wrong, but the Mike Salam, the Dizengoff. They have the hummus place
Dizengoff.
There now. Yeah,
Dizengoff.
Plus, I read food words. I don't say them out loud. So I mispronounce everything. Yeah, they've got that. There's a whole bunch of cool things in there. There's my mom's favorite chocolate shop, Lilac, up there now. So
thank
there's
you.
A lot.
Thanks.
Hi. Speaking of the chicken delivery, if you're talking about prescription chicken, is that who you met?
There's say that again.
I'm short.
Sorry.
The chicken delivery, is it prescription chicken, the one that you met?
Which
in D.C.?
I literally met them twice. Yes, sorry.
Is that what?
Sorry. I was trying to remember. I don't even think they told me the name, but yes, they have a chicken noodle soup business chicken soup business. Yeah. Am I saying it correctly? I'm doing bad advertising here. It sounds amazing, and I want them to move to New York so I can stop making chicken soup.
Oh, it's amazing. And they have a package that's like a hangover cure with turmeric. So good.
All right.
You've got the right audience.
My question, though, a lot of your recipes are family recipes. Mm-hmm. For example, your mom's apple cake, which has become like not my mom's apple cake. and I was wondering, in your perspective, which recipes that you've created would you want to be your family recipes that your kids create?
Sweet.
Wow. I have never thought about that. I feel like it has to be a galette or something, but I don't know. I have to see how it goes with the crumb cake in the new book, but I am like that. I just love that recipe so much, and it took me 13 or 14 rounds to get it right. So I have like my blood, sweat, and tears in there, not to make
it
sound unappetizing.
Child.
What?
It's your third child.
But I'm hoping, I kind of hope it's something that could be around for a while because I feel strongly about crumb cake and I want that to be the one that people use.
Thanks.
Hi. So I want to start by saying that I'm getting married this year, and I'm using one of your recipes for the menu, so thank you so much.
Which one?
The butternut squash tahini one.
You are?
I am.
Wow.
I am. I'm really excited.
That's awesome.
And the family, I'm sure, will be just as excited. So I would like to ask, I mean, it actually tails off of that, but you use such really neat combinations. I mean, I just saw in the book that I received today that it's almost a similar recipe, but you're using, it was a chickpea as well as tahini and some other pieces in it. And you also are very innovative with, pomegranate. Where does that really come from, or do you just taste and see? And also, have there been really good combinations that you like or really bad combinations that you've seen?
The combinations are either from, you know, something I was hungry for or craving, but quite often it's from a restaurant. Like, I'll get an idea. It's not the restaurant's dish, but I'll have, like, lime and brown butter on, like, a cauliflower or I think that came from somewhere where I just, you know, I'd had it and I'd never had it together before, so I'll extract a flavor I like and apply it to something more doable at home in a way that I could make it more often. So I get a lot of inspiration from other kitchens and flavor combinations. And then there are just like random ones that like stay with me and that there's a not kosher at all recipe for miso maple ribs in the book. And I have been trying to figure out what I wanted to do with miso and maple together for years.
And I just, because I love it together, and I had tried to apply it to a bunch of different things, and the ribs were my favorite. I also have, there's a another meat dish, the bulgogi tacos, which I'm probably pronouncing wrong too. And I've used that marinade for so many things over the years. I've put it on chicken, I've put it on brisket, I've put it on like a noodle dish, and I've used it on so many things, and I hadn't found a home for it yet, and it ended up being there. So sometimes I have these disparate recipe parts, just like waiting.
And what was the worst combination that you accidentally made?
What am I thinking?
You block those, typically.
I think I block it. I feel like I've had some good duds lately, and I'm going to think of it later. I haven't.
No pressure.
It's not off
the
top of my head. I've had some really good flops lately. I think I've blocked them out.
Next question.
Hi there. First, speaking of miso, the sweet potato broccoli miso bowl thing is my favorite thing to bring new parents.
Oh, wow.
It's awesome because you can eat it like cold, room temperature, with one hand when you're juggling
babies. Oh, that's
great.
That's a great tip. Thank you.
The question that I had is, one of my favorite things about reading your books and your blog is the language that you use to describe things. Like, even tonight when you were talking about sumac, and you're like, and it's this rubbly red texture on vegetable. And I'm like, oh my God, like, I would never think to say rubbly. Like, all these things. What are the things that you read that are not cookbooks that, like, sort of build your language repertoire? Like, how do you, like, think of the ways to describe things?
I am not the reader that I used to be. It's really
me
sad.
I have
used
kids
to
the
read
same ages. I know exactly
avidly.
What you mean.
And I still get back to it. Like, when I'm on vacation, I could almost finish a book a day. But when I'm on a kid-free vacation.
Yeah.
When you're not on a trip.
Those happen all the time, as you imagine. I feel like I'm going to be so boring. I read The New Yorker. Like, what?
Yeah.
I still don't know why they do the two dots over, like, reunion and certain words. I've Googled it before.
Yeah.
I do read about just about everything I can get my hands on, though. And then there are certain blogs that I read just because I've always loved the writing. You know, I've always read, like, Orangette and Wednesday Chef. I love the way she talks about food.
Mm-hmm.
I like people who have a way with words.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like when it comes to just like day-to-day reading, the more sources, the better. I feel like that with recipes too. Like, I like to kind of get everything I can grab and then read it all and digest it all and then just like push it away and extract what I wanted from it.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot.
I thought you were going to say song lyrics from your music store days.
No, I'm thinking of all the writers I follow on Twitter, but that's not as interesting.
So I have two small undeep questions, because, you know, I'm not like...
Nothing about feminism or...
Feminism, like, no, I just... what is your favorite midnight snack, and what type of music do you listen to?
Oh, my God. Midnight snack, I would say I have a weakness for popcorn. I don't actually ever eat in the middle of the night, though. I'm, like, really boring.
No,
I don't even worry.
I go to bed at 9:30. It's
fine. I would say definitely popcorn is one of my favorite things. I love it air pop, like, you know, to do it in a kettle. Well, I was just in Chicago, and the person who was taking me around showed me this little shop in Wheaton. It's the width of a doorway. It looks like something out of Harry Potter. The store has been there since 1921, and all they do is make popcorn. And I know you think I'm going to say cheese popcorn or carrot. No, all they do, it's like lightly buttered and lightly salted. And they do it in the whirl, like you come in and they're doing the whirly kettle. And I thought I was in heaven. The little bags are 75 cents. Like, it's just... It was like the loveliest place. And this snack was in the car for 2 days, and I'm like, I'm not hungry, I'm not. I couldn't stop. And the worst thing is, I'm like, you know, it's from the earth, it's corn, so it's probably
fine.
Good for you.
Like, it's a vegetable.
It's a vegetable. It is, though, right? Isn't it? Especially all that butter and salt. So I would say that's definitely one of my snack weaknesses. Also, sharp cheddar. I love, like, sharp cheddar is. Definitely a very good thing.
Pie or cake?
Pie, I think,
okay.
Maybe.
Just wondered.
It depends on the cake. You know, that crumb cake is, like, almost dangerous. Like, I can't have it at home. But baked fruit, especially with a nice crumb topping on it. I mean, that's breakfast. It's fruit. It has like oats and nuts and stuff. It's like health food, right? Put some yogurt on it, call it a day. Sorry. And the second question was, how about
music? What kind of music do you listen to?
I listen to a little bit of everything. So I have this, you know, I worked at a record store for years. I actually briefly ran my college radio station. It was very small for a year. So I have like this kind of eclectic music thing.
So what like you listening to?
But for example, I was listening to Lucinda Williams on the train down here. I love her. But still I have my old Liz Phair. I never got rid of Liz Phair. So I've got that. I would say those are kind of like the staples, and then it's just like a mix. I mean, I've never stopped listening to Morrissey or the Smiths either, even though I know they're insufferable. And then I can't even tell you what rap album I downloaded last week because I like was just like, oh, that sounds good, and I downloaded it, and then I'm like, I don't even know what I'm listening to. I just like it.
Nice.
I read about it on like GQ.com. I'm like, okay, that sounds good.
Awesome. Thank you.
Hi. This comes from my very jealous older sister. She wants to know, what meal do you make the most?
Probably dinner. But... mostly because if I don't make dinner, things get very ugly, very quickly. But before that, I would say breakfast or sort of some sort of brunchy thing. I don't do
any
a lot of
particular
lunch.
Recipe at dinner.
For dinner?
Yeah.
I think that was the question.
Sorry, I thought you were asking which meal I make the most. Anyway,
I didn't ask it well.
So I feel like I completely missed that. I'm gonna blame my clogged ears. The thing that I make the most, I would say in terms of like, you know, for dinner. Basically every vegetable on a sheet tray roasted until blistered with some sort of olive oil and well seasoned, and then anything else I can throw on it. I feel like it's funny because I'm actually shocked nobody's asked me about the Instant Pot yet because I've
I was on my list.
I spend like 25% of my time now asking. But I think about what that's good for, and then I think of the sheet tray cooking, and it's really the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I think it's really funny that we call it it's just called roasting things, but we call it sheet
tray
cooking
on a little pan.
Yeah, it's just marketing. But yeah, we just really like cauliflower, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, potatoes, like anything. Roasted really well, well seasoned, and from there you can throw any dressing on it or mix it in a bowl with grains or add some protein. Or, you know, in 2017 parlance, put an egg on it.
Can I ask one more?
Mm-hmm.
I know you took a recent trip, and I was just wondering, it's to Spain?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What did you eat
there?
Is
it still called Spain if I was in Catalonia?
Yeah.
I actually barely have been to Spain. I have actually not been to Spain officially speaking. Sorry.
I was just wondering what you ate there and like what you sort of flavors you're gonna bring back or.
We did a lot of tapas because we have kids and it was a good way to eat early. Although, after being in the country for a week and a half, I think I'm not buying it that they eat as late as they say they did. We had restaurants like shutting down before we were done. That said, definitely ate a lot of. You know, obviously there were a lot of pork products. Many, many, many formats of fried potatoes. I did not leave any fried potatoes behind.
Rightly so.
Not a lot of salad. I think people do eat salad, but it's more of something you eat at home. A lot of potato tortillas.
And sauces, like romesco, you have?
Yes, so good. I'm trying to, God, what else?
Did you eat the little things that are in the shells, cockles, or the barnacles?
No, why not? I did that. I must have done it wrong. I think we had I'm trying to remember. We ate really well there, though. We had a good time, and I found that the food was pretty friendly to kids, too, which was nice.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Sally, Deb, thank you so much for being here. We're so grateful to you.
That's it.
Thank you. Thanks. Yay. Right?
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts at slate.com.